Thank you for having me again. So this talk, I'm looking forward to. So this is kind of the meat of what I'll be talking about. So I'll be talking about the origin of these supernatural ideas and belief. And just to kind of give you a little bit of background on my personal life, I finished my clinical psychology master's and then in California, and then we moved to Oxford because Michael was going to pursue a theology degree. And at that point, I still was still trying to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. And as it would happen, I met Justin Barrett, who's a Christian psychologist who looks at a lot of these ideas. And what he was doing was combining his interest in child psychology, developmental psychology, and religious ideas. And I thought, as a Christian, it's fascinating that you can do that. I've never heard of this before. And so I got more into it. I started to work for him and then realized, I want to do a PhD in this. This is fascinating. So this is kind of the background of what we did together and what he's done and what other people have done in this. So it's mainly, so what we're looking at, so the origin of supernatural ideas, we're looking at through the lens of developmental psychology. So we're looking at how children develop concepts of God, how they understand God, who is God to them. As we look at children, how they develop these ideas, it's also how we understand as adults how these ideas come naturally to us. So I'll be talking about cognitive mechanisms. So I alluded to them yesterday. So there's certain ideas in our cognition that come really easily to us. And there's certain tools. Remember that Swiss Army knife? There's certain tools that we have in our mind that we use to engage with the world and to engage with God. So these are the cognitive mechanisms that I'll be talking about. The first is theory of mind, which is also the acronym TOM. I'll be talking about that. There's the hypersensitive agency detection device. These I will all explain in a bit, so this is just a brief introduction. Also, the minimal counterintuitive ideas, MCI ideas, we'll be talking about those, and promiscuous teleology. So these are four tools in our Swiss Army knife that we talk about conceptually in our mind. So I want to talk, just to start with a quote from Richard Dawkins. So as many of you know, he's an avid atheist. This is a quote from him. There are opinions about the cosmos and the world that children, once grown, presumably be in a position to evaluate for themselves. Religion is the one field in our culture about which it is absolutely accepted, without question, without even noticing how bizarre it is that parents have a total and absolute say in what their children are going to be, how their children are going to be raised, what opinions their children are going to have about the cosmos, about life, about existence. Do you see what I mean about mental child abuse? That's a very strong opinion, what he thinks, how religion is created. And he also says, children blindly accept from authorities propositions about the world, about the cosmos, about morality, and about human nature. And what we want to say with the research that we've been doing, that's bogus. That's not what's happening. So it's called the indoctrination hypothesis. So you say that children just blindly just believe in these ideas, but it's not true. Children actually come into the world biased to think about supernatural ideas, and I'm going to tell you about these studies. So it's completely bogus what Dawkins is talking about. So this is, let me introduce you to Justin Barrett. This is my PhD supervisor. He's a Christian psychologist. In your right-hand corner, those are two books that he's written, very accessible books. I highly recommend them. So what he says is that children are actually, children and adults, all of us, we're born believers. We're born believing and able to think about these ideas about God. So I'll be showing you some studies, evidence that suggests that we have a remarkable tendency to believe in gods and supernatural agents and other religious ideas. These come naturally to us. It's very intuitive. So let's get into the meat of it. So a lot of times in psychology, people talk about blank slate. So that babies are just blank slate. They don't know anything. But in psychology, we've been finding out this is completely untrue. Babies come into the world knowing quite a bit about the world. So let me tell you a few things what they actually do know. So in the domain of physics, children actually know about gravity. You don't have to tell them about it. They know it. So when babies, they drop a ball, they often look to the side, or they drop a spoon in their high chair. They're looking over to the side, and they see that things have dropped to the floor. There's these amazing studies where the psychologist will drop something, but they've actually rigged it on a screen. The child can't see, and it stops in midair. And the baby will look longer at it, because it's that's different. That's not what we would expect. So children know that when you drop things, they should drop to the floor. So they have some understanding of physics already when they're infancy. And this is with, I mean, weeks old babies, they understand. Children also know quite a bit about other people. So when you show them a person who basically reaches towards something, they have a good idea, I'm reaching for this object. But if you show just a stick being extended, they don't understand what that stick is, what that stick's doing. There's something about humans and other ages that we have intention. And children know this, so they understand that when we interact with each other, it's very different. There's something very intuitive about agency, about when we're interacting with each other. And children know this from a very young age. They don't have to be taught this. Also in the domain of biology, it's very intuitive, so when you ask a child, okay, a cat is gonna have, it's pregnant, it's going to be having something. Is it gonna be having dragons? Is it going to be having dogs? You know that cats give birth to kittens. It's not something else. There's certain aspects that are very intuitive to them about biology. They don't really have to be taught about this. Through their experience in the world, they have these tools that they understand the world. And these same tools actually bias us to think about God as well. So let's start talking about them. So here's the first one, theory of mind. So we're just talking about the domain of psychology, the domain of understanding other people. So theory of mind is our ability to attribute mental states, such as intentions, feelings, emotions, beliefs, knowledge, and desires. And actually, children take a while to develop this as they experience others. It takes quite a bit of time. So up until 5 years, they're still developing this understanding of what. So if a child says, I like pizza, at 3 years old, they're probably going to say, everyone else likes pizza. It's not until between 4 and 5 that they start to realize, okay, I might like pizza, but you actually may not like pizza. You actually may like broccoli, which is very surprising to a 3-year-old. So let me show you what this looks like. So how people test theory of mind in psychology, it's called a theory of mind test or a false belief test. And you show them, this is a cracker box. And you say, what do you think is inside this box? And they say, oh, there's crackers inside. Okay, that's great, but let me show you what's actually inside the box. So you open it up, and it shows something surprising. So let's pretend there's rocks actually inside the box. You close it back up and say, what's actually inside the box? There's rocks inside the box. Okay, now let's pretend that your mom just walked into the room and we show her this box. What do you think she's gonna say that's inside the box? And the 3-year-old, who doesn't have theory of mind, what do you think a 3-year-old would say? Rocks. Yeah, they don't even think mom thinks there's rocks inside the box. It's not till 5 when you ask them, what do you think mom is gonna say inside the box? They're gonna think, she didn't see that you showed me there's rocks inside the box. So she probably thinks she's going to be fooled and thinks there's crackers. But the interesting thing is, so some Christian psychologists did this task with kids, and they asked them about God. So to a 3-year-old, they asked, okay, what do you think God would think is inside the box? And the 3-year-old, God knows there's rocks inside the box, which is the right answer. And at 5, so when you have this theory in mind, what do you think 5-year-olds would say? So 5-year-olds also say, God knows there's rocks inside the box. So Justin Barrett, who did this study, he thinks that these ideas of omniscience are very easy for a child to figure out. So even when you talk to a 3-year-old, they often think that their parents are omniscient. So they think that the mom and dad do know everything. It takes a period of time for them to realize, actually, mom and dad don't know everything. So this is kind of one of those mechanisms that predispose us to think about omniscient means. So this is very important. So when we talk about theory of mind and psychology, when they don't pass this task, they say other beings think that there's rocks inside the box. And if they do pass, so we can say, okay, this child has acquired theory of mind, is when they've said that mom thinks the crackers inside the box. So that's how it works. So I want to show you a little girl who doesn't quite have theory of mind yet, just so you can get a picture for what this looks like developmentally.
Do you know what this is?
Crayons.
Crayons. If I open the box, What would be inside?
Pants.
Good. Let's open the box and see what's inside. What's inside?
M&M's.
What's really inside the box?
M&M's.
Before I opened it, what did you think was inside the box?
Pants.
That's right. I'm going to close the box now. Now, Jenna is outside. If Jenna comes back in the room, what will she say is inside the box?
M&M's.
She should have said crayons. So before I introduce this next concept, I think I'm going to play with you another video. And I want you just to watch it. It's a few minutes long, but afterwards I'm going to ask perhaps some of you to tell me what you thought the video was about. So go ahead and enjoy this. Can I have a volunteer who's willing to tell me what they thought that video was about?
Domestic violence.
Can you tell me what happened?
Dad was alone, and then the mom and the kid came, and then dad was starting to beat the mom and the kid got scared.
Great, thank you for sharing. Anyone else? Linda?
Mother and child, and then the circle was a pet running around.
Great. Well, you all are susceptible to this mechanism. This is great. So, so great, great, I think, interpretations of what that video was about. So HAD stands for Hypersensitivity Agency Detection Device. So this is the device that we detect agency everywhere. So those were just, it was a triangle, a circle, a square, and you all were attributing feelings, desires, thoughts, a whole narrative to these shapes that were just moving around in the space. So this was a study done in the 40s by Heider and Simmel. And they were actually studying something completely different, but they found that their subjects were giving explanations like we both were. So what psychologists have taken this as is that we attribute agency so easily and so naturally to things that actually shouldn't have agency at all. Shapes and triangles, they shouldn't have any kind of thoughts or desires. We so easily attributed emotions and feelings to these shapes. So this is another mechanism that we actually use to think about gods, supernatural agents, because they're not actually around us. We can't see God. We do attribute to him certain thoughts and desires, and this device helps us to do that. So we think about agency that actually we probably shouldn't in shapes, but it's the same mechanism that thinks about that we think about God who's not really there. So let's look at some other examples of HAD.
So what hypersensitive, what's the word again?
Hypersensitive agency detection device. Yeah. A long phrase. So when we look at this, what do you see?
Three dots.
Very good.
Triangle.
Does anyone see a face? Two eyes and maybe a mouth? So this is another way of where a head comes into play, where you don't really see it with this, with three triangles. It's kind of the opposite. Here are some other examples that a lot of people tend to see certain things. So faces in the clouds, and they're red, and they're cookie, and even Henry, the vacuum cleaner. So here's another concept, another mechanism that we use. So this is another long terminology, minimal counterintuitive theory. What this suggests is that things that are minimal, so they go counter to our intuitions, are fascinating. So anything that's, and what Pascal Boyer, who came up with this term, is trying to say, anything that's minimally counterintuitive, so not something, so I think I talked about the green monster who only spoke on Tuesday yesterday. It's kind of a very counterintuitive concept. You probably didn't talk about it last night. You probably didn't even remember it because it's strange. But if you look at something minimal, like a talking toaster, that's something that's minimally counterintuitive. It might be something that we'll go away today and talk about the talking toaster, but I doubt it. There's things like elves. Elves are counterintuitive in that they're immortal. They live forever. That's something that's counter to what humans are. We're very mortal people. So that's something that's a very counterintuitive concept. We also have ghosts. So ghosts don't have bodies. That's very counterintuitive. We all have bodies. We're physical. We go against a wall, we hit it, or a ghost, presumably, would walk, float through the door or through the wall. So these are the type of ideas that Pascal Boyer talks about because they're minimally counterintuitive, they're interesting. We talk about them, they're the stuff that make up our stories. We see movies about it, we see books about it. People are fascinated by these ideas. And if they're interesting, they're worth transmitting, they're worth talking about. So this is another common mechanism. So all these, if you think about all of these ideas as a package, so we're starting to talk about each of these mechanisms, start to thread through how we start to believe and originate these ideas about God. So this is one of my favorites, because of the terminology, promiscuous teleology. So teleology is finding purpose in things, and promiscuous means that we do it all the time, we do it to everything. And so there's a psychologist named Deborah Kalman at Boston University, and she's the person that came up with this idea, because she found that with her own kids, that they were attributing purpose to everything. So if you look at this object, I think it's a microphone, but my first instinct is, what is the purpose for this? It looks strange. So we have this natural inclination to think about purpose. So what she did, she designed some questions to ask some kids. So these are some examples of her questions and actually what the children said. So why do you think the rocks are so pointy? So you can give a very logical answer, but most of the kids were giving teleological answers. So children responded, they were pointy so that animals wouldn't sit on them and smash them. Which really, you could say something like, they were pointy because bits of stuff piled up on top of one another for a long time. Not a very interesting answer, but the kids were going to the teleological response. Here's some others. Why did the first ever bird exist? To make nice music. Because it made the world look nice. Why did the first monkey exist? So that we had somebody to climb trees, so there'd be an animal in the jungle. Why did the first mountain exist? They made mountains. Who's they? So people can look at them. Why did the first river exist? So boats could come in the water, so that people could do fishing. So these are the type of responses that kids were just naturally giving. And actually, when you give these questions to adults and you give them choices, so you can give them kind of a more logical response, you can give them a teleological response, and something that's just another sentence. If you do it timed, adults are very susceptible to this as well. So it's not just kids. Now when you take this question further, so a child of the previous life said they created something. So the psychologist said, well, who are they talking about when they say they, or someone was creating these things? They took it a step further. So we've been talking about mountains, rivers, monkeys, birds. Now here's the question. Did someone or something make the first ever mountain exist? Or did it just happen? So under half of the children said someone made natural events. Over half said someone made natural objects. And 73% said someone made animals. So these are kids of various backgrounds. These aren't kids that are from a Christian background. So this is a natural idea that kids intuitively feel that someone created natural objects, that someone created animals. So they took it a step further. Okay, so if you said someone made these things, who made these things? And they gave them a few options. Was it made by people? Was it made by God? Or no one knows. And children were 7 times more likely to say that God made these objects. And these are kids, again, that aren't from Christian backgrounds, but they intuitively feel that someone who's not a person, but God, made these objects. So this is another study by another psychologist in Michigan, and she was interested in kind of how children look at, so if children do believe this, that God created the natural world, how are they engaging with other ideas about evolution? So what the psychologist did was she took a group of Christian children and a group of children that were from homes that kind of gave a more evolutionary background, and she wanted to see how kids were thinking about these ideas. So she introduced them to the sun bear, to the tuatara, and to a human being, and she asked how these were created, who created them, and what they found was that creationist accounts and spontaneous accounts were the ones that were endorsed. So no matter what background they were from, children of people that were from evolutionary accounts or creationist accounts said that God created these things. And these were 5 to 9 year olds. So these were older kids, and so they've actually been in school for quite some time, but it's more intuitive for children to think about that someone created the earth than to think that they were spontaneously created. So again, these cognitive mechanisms of play, but it's very easy for children to think about these ideas. And of course, if children find it so easy, we as adults find these ideas very natural and intuitive. So then some researchers said, well, then are children just gullible? Do they just think about these ideas? They don't even have to be told, they're just really gullible about these ideas. So Paul Harris at Harvard University said, well, let's test this out. How gullible are these kids? So he asked them about 3 different types of things. So he categorized them as non-endorsed entities, endorsed entities, and scientific entities. So non-endorsed entities are things like mermaids and ghosts, so things that we kind of tell in our folklore, they're in stories, but no one ever in our culture would say, I believe in mermaids, I believe in ghosts. So it's kind of not something that's commonly said. Whereas you have endorsed entities, so things that people would say that they do believe in. So they believe in God, or they believe in the tooth fairy. So they had endorsed entities as well. But he also wanted to find out, so some scientific entities. So germs and oxygen, people say they exist, but we can't see them. We take that for granted. So he wanted to see how good children are at distinguishing between these 3 different types of things. And what they found were that kids aren't gullible. Yes, they talk about mermaids, they talk about ghosts, but they don't believe in them. But what's interesting, so kids that not only are Christians, but also a variety of different kinds of backgrounds, they believe in God and the endorsed entities, but they also believe in the scientific ones. It's very interesting to view. So these are all cultural concepts that they've taken in, but they're not gullible.
Gullible är godtroende. Eller, ja, nej, godtroende.
Thank you. This is one of my favorite studies. It's called the Princess Alice Study. And what the psychologist's name is Jesse Baring, what he wanted to do was to see how this works in society. So if we have a God that kind of organizes our society and is a very moral influence, how does that affect our behavior if we believe in a God that exists but we cannot see? So he designed this study called the Princess Alice Study. And he told them, he showed them a picture of Princess Alice and said, this is Princess Alice. She's not here right now. She has a special ability. She has a magical power to be invisible. And she's here right now. She's sitting in this chair. And he said, but we're going to play a game. I'm going to leave the room, but Princess Alice is going to stay here. What the game is, see this Velcro dartboard in the background? If you get as many darts on that dartboard, you get a special prize. But you have to get a lot of darts on that dartboard. The catch is, you have to
go from behind. So you can't see the dartboard. You have to face it from behind and throw it with your non-dominant hand. So if you're right-handed, you throw it with your left hand. So he wanted to see what kids would do. If Princess Alice was in the room, how they would do it. It's practically an impossible task. If you can't see the dartboard, it's really hard to hit that dartboard. But he had three different groups. So he had the Princess Alice group, so the ones that got to be in the room with Princess Alice in the chair. He had another group where the researcher actually just stayed in the room, so he didn't tell them about Princess Alice. And then he had another group where it was just kids could do whatever they wanted. And what they found was, so the kids that could do whatever they wanted, there wasn't anyone in the room. They didn't tell them about Princess Alice, and the researcher wasn't in the room. The kids cheated incredibly. They wanted to get that special prize, so when they thought no one was looking, they were facing the dartboard and just throwing the dartboards. But in the groups where Princess Alice was there and the researcher was there, there was hardly any cheating. So in the group, of course, where the psychologist was there, they could see that she was there. But in the Princess Alice, it was enough for them to think, well, if Princess Alice is watching, I can't cheat. But I want to show you this video of this boy who, he's in the Princess Alice condition. So Princess Alice is in the chair. And you see him kind of wondering, is she really there? He comes over, sits on the chair. He goes, is she really there? And he starts to doubt. He doesn't think that she's there. And then he starts cheating. So I want you to take a look at this. There's Princess Alice in the chair. He feels her. And then he starts cheating. And then he's waiting for the psychologist to come back to get the special prize. Psychologists talk about, but there are people looking at a variety of different things, so how ritual works, how we think about magic, so certain, obviously some of these ideas also relate to certain magical ideas, the tooth fairy, and other types of creatures. The transmission of religious ideas, so there's a lot of research about how these ideas spread, so we have prayer, we have reincarnation, we have souls, minds, and bodies, we talked a little bit about that before, there's a lot of research about that. And that also relates to spirit possession, so the separation of mind and body. So if you're interested, there's lots of stuff out there. So just some conclusions, trying to wrap some of this together. So we have these cognitive mechanisms. So I've talked about four of them. There's many more. But in collaboration, so if we tied all of these ideas together, these mechanisms actually help us. It's a built-in understanding of the world, but it's a built-in understanding of understanding God as well. So we have certain cognitive mechanisms that may bias us to entertain ideas of things that we cannot see. And so these are also the same ideas that make us think about God as well. So I've just said a lot. I want to make sure that you guys have an opportunity for questions as well, if you have any. And I'm obviously here the whole weekend, so I can talk informally as well. But if you have any questions, please do ask. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Okay, so lunch is in 15 minutes, så let's just, okay, we'll do this in Norwegian. Lunch om 15 minutter, Solveig bare sjekker om vi skal, ja, hvordan det funker. Hvis dere ønsker, ja, and we'll switch to English again. If you have any questions, we have 15 minutes now. So if you want to get some fresh air, feel free to do that. So lunch is in 15 minutes in the dining hall. Okay? There's actually some space in the program here, so use it as you wish. And Emily is available for questions now.
And this MCI thing, is it for every phenomenon that is surprising, that seems surprisingly for us?
It's anything that goes counter to what the natural world is. So if we think about humans, we're bodies that have mentality, but we are bodies that are limited. We cannot go through walls. We're not immortal. So immortality would be counterintuitive. Going through walls would be counterintuitive. If you think of the toaster, a toaster is, it's not an animate being. It's just an entity, it's stable. But if you attribute mentality to it, so if it's a talking toaster, that's counterintuitive because you've now given the trait of mentality to the toaster. So it's these kind of ideas that make
more
sense.
It's not everything that is surprising.
No, it's not everything that's surprising. So what's a good example? I think there was a bleeding door. I think that's surprising, and it could be possibly counterintuitive because you're attributing biology to it, but it's not technically an MCI idea. It's surprising.
What about like a leg that is growing while you look at it, like in healing? Someone has seen.
So a lot of people talk about miracles. So they look at miracles with these ideas because miracles are counter to what the norm is. So bringing people back from life or curing disease. Those would be counterintuitive because they do go counter to what our biology would suggest that we can do. So God works in those ways. Just cool.
So what you find is that it's still intuitive. What is counterintuitive is really intuitive.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're coming from the basis of what's intuitive. And then you're looking at these counter ideas. The basis is intuitive. So all these biases are intuitive to us. But what goes counter is actually what's interesting. Anything else?
Yeah,
so that's a good question. So the question is about, so obviously to have an understanding of God, they had to have understood the word God. So that is a cultural concept that they would have to pick up. So in those homes, of course they had to have understood God. I think the interesting thing is, even though they understood who God was, and they were in, a lot of the children were in homes where they weren't being taught about God. They were being taught kind of either a more spontaneous account or an evolutionary account or an atheist account. But they still had this intuition that someone created the world. It was their intuition that someone did. In my own research, when I was talking to, so I interviewed a bunch of families in Oxford, about 100 of them. When I got the privilege, a lot of them were from atheist homes, and they were just interested in what their children would say. So I went to a family, and I went to their home. It was with the, I think it was 4.5 years old. And the mother was there, and so I was asking him basically like the false belief tests, so with the crackers. And he was saying, oh, God would know that there's rocks inside the box. And I was asking other questions about what types of things God would know. And God knows what I did, you know, for my birthday. God knows what I had for breakfast and these type of things. And the mother is sitting there looking at the child like she has no idea what's coming out of this child. I'm just really perplexed. And I would also ask the same questions to adults just to try and see if there was any differences or similarities. And the mother, you know, she was saying, no, it's because I don't believe in God. No, I don't think, you know, God would know this. If God existed, maybe he probably would know this type of thing. And the child was getting distressed. Mom, why are you saying no? The answer is yes, God knows these things. And she was sitting there, she's like, I have never said a word about God to my child. I don't know where he's picked up these ideas. We're going to have some things to talk about afterwards, I think. But it was very interesting to watch that interaction because intuitively, and somewhere, he picked up the concept of God. But he also picked up that he thought that God was omniscient, that he knew things. So I thought that was very, very interesting. And actually, there's one family that was an atheist family who became Christians because of this. The child would not stop asking about God, and so she heard about a play group. They went to it and actually became Christians. So I thought that was a very cool consequence of this child just wanting to know who God was. So I hope that answers your question.
Why you call it a bias? Can you say more about that? Like, why you call this a bias?
We call it a bias. So some people like to say wired, and we are trying not to say that people are pre-wired. That sounds very neurological or biological. We say bias because, as you see from, so like had, it sounded like there was a bias to think about intentions and desires with the shapes that we're moving around. Some people say default is another word. So it's just another way of saying that when you look at the world, we have certain predispositions is another word that people use. So we don't want to say people are wired. It's not a definite thing, because there are certain, so even though it's an intuition, it's a predisposition, we're not ready to say that everyone has it. So we kind of are biased. You're bent to kind of think that way.
The discussion previously, not with, with AMC, I kind of said we wanted to enter it into discussion about somebody being the Bible as an historical document has sort of a lot of, you know, where believers are acceptance amongst a lot of historians, but a lot of other people would not approve it the same way as you do a lot of philosophical documents with far less circulation and everything, right? Copies. And one of the arguments is that it, because of the actual supernatural content, that's why, you know, it's not the document itself, but it, you know, you read about things that you're not able to accept or agree upon. And so I was just wondering, in terms of psychology, with it, if it's just some of the truths or the contents or whatever in the Bible are far too sort of too much to comprehend. It's not like the maximum counterintuitive part with all the sort of death and resurrection, or just like what are you capable of being sort of human, accepting discrepancy being so large. So I'm just wondering if MCI or maybe maximal counterintuitive is a way of explaining why it's hard to believe. Mm-hmm. Because you have a frame set and to have that anchor from being so far away from, yeah, what you're taught up to do or what is intuitive. I don't know if you get my question.
Yes, no, that's a great question, and that's something that Justin Barrett has really wrestled with, because people think, isn't God maximally counterintuitive? Because he breaks all of these barriers. He's not exactly intuitive. But what he's done some other studies that look at kind of, so just the different parts of who we think God is. And so when we break, this is going to sound, when we break them apart into little components, it's easy for us to think about it, but we actually need what's called a cultural ratcheting, or we need doctrine and theology to build kind of what we think about God. So yesterday I was talking about folk religion, but also theological correctness. And this is the aspect where, so we start from this basic concept of God. It's very easy for us to think about a God that's omniscient, a God that knows things. But then we need to build upon that, and that's where Christian theology comes in, that we need those other kind of cultural concepts to scaffold how we think about God. Because these are very rich concepts that don't come naturally to us. But we can start from the basis that we have these basic ideas of who God is. We can think about him, we know that he's omniscient, we know that he's probably omnipotent, that comes so very natural, but then we need to build on these concepts. But that's interesting what you say about a maximally counterintuitive idea. I think that is why people have a hard time with it, because they actually have to spend time reflecting. It's reflective practice, it's not an intuitive one. So just the intuitive practice of thinking about God, we need the reflection to kind of build upon these more complex ideas, and why we need church, why we need each other, why we need the Bible to think about it. Does that answer your questions?
Okay, just some quick info, and then we'll see if we can fit in your question. So lunch starts in 4 minutes. It's a buffet, so just walk in there, grab your stuff, and sit down. There's also dessert. That's on, at a different table. We start up here again at 1:45 for another session. So you have 45 minutes to eat and take a break. Then we have a 30-minute session with Emily again, and then we're doing group discussions after that. And then there's 3 hours of free time before dinner. So just to give you a framework. Okay, so quick question, and then let's move in there so we can start the meal.
To me, a lot of these results can just as easily be used as an argument for evolutionary psychology. You know, it's really disturbing not having like meaning and intentions and everything, and especially for a small child, it's a lot easier to have like congruent intentions, and it's a much simpler idea than thinking everything is just a coincidence. You know, that's a very, very but it's a very hard concept to get, because it's a lot more adaptive to think. You know, we're trying to always like predict people's behavior and all those things that we're wired to do. But then you said something like these are actually more about intelligent designs, arguments for intelligent design. Can you just talk a bit more about that? Because I wasn't sure if I.
So the distinction between what those psychologists are trying to do with an evolutionary and creationist accounts?
What would you say if I say, well, this is just adaptive mechanisms, it's not but then I hear you say something more, actually, I would say that this goes towards intelligent design kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So asking you, what's your counter-argument against that?
Well, there's two things. A lot of people would say, okay, we've got these cognitive mechanisms, they're actually probably just a byproduct of how we see the world.
Yeah.
Justin Barrett he's the Christian psychologist, he's in that camp. He does think it's a byproduct of actually understanding the world, but he doesn't see that as a problem as a Christian. It's kind of, that's how God has created us. So the same tools that we use to understand the world is the same tools that we use to understand supernatural ideas and how we come to believe. There's other people that would say it's an adaption. So we have these tools, but we start using them to do other things, to create a moral society. So to create churches, to kind of control the behavior of society, that would be an adaption. So I think I'm more on the byproduct camp, but I don't find that threatening. I think that God has created us with these tools in mind, that the same tools that we understand each other, that we understand the natural world, how physics work, is also how we come to understand God. Does that answer your question?
It's fine, I think it's a bit unclear to me as well.
Okay. We can talk after. Do we have time for one more?
Lunch is served.
Okay.